Chapter 15. Rook Takes Pawn. Jinzan awoke refreshed. He felt better than he had in a long time. His plan was finally about to start paying back all the work he had put into it. As he pushed back the flap and exited his tent, he found quite a different attitude among his goblin hosts. The autumn air had grown frosty, and the frail, scrawny creatures had little love for the cold. The camp was filled with bored goblins huddling around sorcerer-warmed stones, bundled up in raccoon furs and trying to keep busy until the remainder of their forces arrived. They had been camped on the forested hills just outside of Illard's Glen for 2 days. The small farming and trade community sat across the Neverthaw River. The Neverthaw was a deep, wide river that would bar any reasonable attempt by the goblins to cross, short of building ships. Illard's Glen had a wide bridge that would allow the army to cross. Despite their proximity to the town, they were reasonably secure in their ability to remain undetected. Illard's Glen was woefully understaffed with sorcerers. The goblins' own magic users had been keeping up a constant veil of illusory trees to keep them out of view of the town itself, making the nearby woodlands seem denser to conceal Gathak's encampment. The few Cadrans who had ventured near enough to notice something amiss had been enspelled to believe they had seen nothing. One of the goblins had even hunted a deer and stuck one of the humans' arrows in it before sending them on their way with their prize. Jinzan breathed in the cold morning air and found it invigorating. He wandered over to the cooking area and grabbed 2 bowls of the goblins' mush dawn feast rations. The soggy mixture steamed lightly, the cauldron of it having been warmed over a few stones the sorcerers had heated to a reddish glow. The goblins were not fond of winter, and even the autumn mornings were more than enough to sour them on the weather. Jinzan had spent much of his youth in colder climates and found the morning unworthy of a heavy cloak. The smaller, thinner bodies of the goblins just did not hold heat well. They typically dwelt underground in the winter, with their communities half above and half below ground in more temperate weather.
"Good morning, sorcerer,"
came a voice from behind Jinzan as he searched for a place to sit with his food.
"Good morning yourself, General,"
Jinzan replied, recognizing Gathak's voice. He turned to look at the goblin, not wishing to be any more disrespectful than usual.
"How you are not cold continues amazing me. You humans are either crazy or half bear. Join me over here while you take morning meal."
Gathak gestured to the seat beside him on a cut log. It always amused the sorcerer that the goblins made furniture for their general whenever they stopped for more than a day or so. They were industrious little creatures, even if they were weaklings individually, and he took full advantage. When Jinzan's secret weapons arrived, he was eager to see just how clever they had been.
"Any word of the assassin?"
Jinzan had almost added, "that you sent," to the end of his question, but did not want to be diverted over an argument of who was to blame for his disappearance.
"It has been too long," Gathak conceded.
He had been insisting for days that the assassin would be back any time. It was the first time he admitted something might be wrong.
"We have no choice but to pray he was successful and continue with the plan. We will not turn back."
Jinzan had been pressing for details every night since the assassin was sent to dispatch the Cadran survivors. He knew little about Geklar's skills, but Gathak seemed to have every confidence that he would be able to finish off the half score or so of humans that had been left after the battle at the river. "Do you think he might have had troubles with that magical sword?" Jinzan suggested. "We expected the ambush to destroy them as well. Perhaps we have underestimated them a second time." Gathak's eyes narrowed as he glared at Jinzan.
"I dislike you sometimes, sorcerer. You are right too many times when we disagree. I think this time you are only half right, though. For my guess, I say that the sorcerer the humans had was stronger than we reasoned. The scorch spot where there was an ether burn, there was no human body in that spot. Maybe the sorcerer of theirs survived, If he was strong enough to battle three of our own sorcerers, perhaps he was able to thwart Gatlar. A human sword knight would not have seen Gatlar coming, but maybe a sorcerer did.
It is possible, I suppose. I wonder how much use anyone who caused that ether burn would be, though, so soon after. He must have overextended himself severely to do that sort of damage, just with excess ether. I would rather think that they just kept his body. The Cadrans think much more of sorcerers than they do of their dead soldiers, but if the assassin was defeated, I could see a sorcerer's part in that. I know I do not fear him, Jinzan boasted, not entirely idly. While the assassin might well kill him in his sleep, he was not so easy a mark to sneak up on as most. Jinzan was adept enough that he could perceive the ether even while using his normal sight. It was a half measure of attention, to be sure, like a sort of peripheral vision. But the assassin's source was stronger than most, and Jinzan was generally aware of all sources within a few paces of himself at all times. Most sorcerers, at least among humans, really only saw ether when they blocked out their normal sight. It was yet another reason sorcerers kept out of pitched battles as a rule. Jinzan was not so sure how goblins perceived ether and reality at the same time, though. He suspected that the ability to watch ether and reality at once might be somewhat less rare among their sorcerers, and might possibly be why they were more willing to fight with magic.
Either way, if the assassin was not able to stop the humans reaching help, we may have to deal with reinforcements. I doubt the humans will be able to rally enough forces to stop us, though, especially if your weapons work as well as you claim.
They will. Your artisans are skilled. I think they will be able to follow the plans I gave them. If they build them right, we will have no troubles. Illard's Glen will be a test. We could take the town with just normal forces, but we want to be certain that the new weapons are working as intended.
I am eager to see them in action. You are very certain of their effectiveness for something that has never been made before.
Jinzan simply smiled. It was that same afternoon that the rest of the goblin forces arrived. Their presence would be nearly impossible to hide with the number of troops swelling to over 100,000, filling nearly every available part of the forest within a mile of the tree line. As waves of goblins and entire herds of oxen ambled into the general area of the original campsite, Jinzan searched out the quartermasters of the goblin army. Fortunately for Jinzan, the goblins were a nimble people generally, and Jinzan saw the path before him cleared as he moved. To the goblins, he might as well have been an ogre. There was much chattering as he passed, with many of the newcomers never having seen a human before. Jinzan had a hard enough time picking up conversational goblin speech in small groups, but to his ears, the multitudes might have well have been crickets chirping or hens clucking for all the sense he could make of it. As he passed, he would pick out officers by their uniform and ask a single question in his rudimentary goblin.
Where new weapon?
Back at end, he kept hearing.
He waded onward, careful lest he step on one of his allies and possibly provoke violence. At the distance of a spear throw, he would take his chances against half an army's worth of the little runts. But all about him and armed, he wanted to take extra care to avoid any misunderstandings. After half an hour that seemed like a day, Jinzan made it to the back of the procession. There he found an unusual group. Oxen were the common beasts of burden among the goblins, but this was an animal he had never seen before. There were several eight-legged lizards, nearly Jinzan's height at the shoulder, and even broader across. Their bellies slung nearly to the ground. They were massive, powerful creatures who plodded along hauling carts, each bearing a cargo lashed down with tarps. Jinzan waved his hands over his head as he approached, carefully keeping to the side of the gargantuan lizard's path.
Hold!
He shouted, or at least tried. He nearly choked, trying to yell in goblin. The rider of the lead lizard stopped, and the rest followed suit. Had he not been so eager to inspect their cargo, Jinzan would have been fascinated by the lizards and their riders. The riders sat not on the lizard backs, but saddled to their heads. Due to their multitude of legs working in alternating stride, the backs of the lizards weaved side to side as they walked, but the heads held very steady. And despite the cold-blooded nature of lizards and the chill in the air, the lizards seemed plenty warm. In fact, Jinzan could feel the heat radiating off them as he approached. It seemed to come from a harness of tubes crisscrossing the beasts, attached to a large bladder on their backs.
"What, human? What do you want?"
crackled a wizened old goblin from the head of the lead lizard.
"You the one who drew these devices?"
The goblin was wrinkled and his skin had a more grayish color to it, rather than the typical green hues the younger goblin showed. From what Jinzan knew of goblins, unless this one knew age-slowing magic like humans used, he was probably well past 30. The old goblin wore thick spectacles and a wide, flattened, conical hat that tied under his chin. He was bundled in raccoon furs like most of the other goblins, but Jinzan noticed a pack on his back that looked similar to the one on the lizard. Presumably the tubes went underneath his furs.
"Yes, me one who make."
But the old goblin waved a hand and cut him off.
"You hurt my old ears. I can understand human speech just fine. Speak your own tongue and leave ours in peace. By the great dragon Nehashtek, you shriek like an old lady," the goblin said, then chuckled.
"Fine then. Yes, I am the one who drew the plans for these weapons. I wish to see them now. Show me," he demanded.
"Just like a human. No patience,"
the old goblin said, cackling in amusement. He yelled out to some of the nearby soldiers to unbind the tarps and remove them.
"My name is Kakart. I am the one who oversaw the making of your weapons. Let me tell you, we are 2 days late because you make."
And there was a word Jinzan did not know.
"Like little child, we had to remake them right and fix a lot of mistakes."
Jinzan was a little worried now, as the goblins rushed over and climbed onto the cart, scrambling up the sides by the very straps they were about to remove. He was aware that the goblins would have their own way of doing things, but he thought his specifications were unambiguous. He had hoped that they had not made them different enough that they did not work now. Soon enough, he had his answer. As the last of the goblins got down from the cart, a pair of them pulled off the tarp. Kakart swung the lizard's head around to get a better view, and the creature contorted its body so that it was nearly bent in two. The reins of the lizard's bridle gave the rider control not only over the lizard's walking, but over which way it faced its head. Jinzan's breath caught in his throat, and he gasped in wonder at the sight before him. He approached and reached out to touch the goblin's creation, a long cylinder of polished bronze with silvery bands of a metal he did not recognize, reinforcing it toward the open end. For indeed, one end of the device had a hole that extended down inside. It was a cannon. Jinzan had never actually seen or felt one before, though it was familiar to him as his own robes were. He had seen them nightly in his dreams for a long time. The craftsmanship was exquisite. The surface gleamed, and the bore was straight as a plumb line. It was better than he had hoped. The goblins had outdone themselves.
"Ha ha! You like it, human?"
Kakart asked, smiling.
"Once we fixed your mistakes, it worked much better."
Jinzan's head snapped around, and he looked at Kakart with surprise. "You have tried it?"
"Ha ha! Of course, silly human. We do not make things and bring them to a battle with no testing. Ha ha! We had a wonderful time playing with them, before we worked out the models you see here. Your burning rope triggering for it was the first thing we got rid of."
Jinzan looked at the breech end of the cannon. There was no fuse, nor any place he could see to put one. Instead, he found a box-like contraption welded onto the outside with a metal handle dangling from a chain. The chain seemed not so much to be attached to the box as attached to something inside the box.
"What is this?" Jinzan asked. "What have you done with the fuse?"
"Bah, your silly rope. Your exploding powder needs fire. You put a burning rope in it? Ha ha! What a bad way to get fire inside. Too hard to get the timing. We made a mechanism for lighting the blasting powder that is quicker and more reliable. Just pull the chain and it makes sparks inside."
The goblin chuckled as he spoke, clearly enjoying the feeling of superiority over the cannon's inventor. Jinzan grasped hold of the chain and looked askance at Kakurt.
"Go ahead and pull. Quick tug. Not too hard. It was made for my kind to use. Do not break it,"
Kakurt instructed, miming a tugging action. Jinzan pulled the chain and heard a scraping, metal-on-metal snick from within the box. When he let go, the chain pulled itself back to its original length. Jinzan did not perceive any ether at work and was not sure how they had managed that, unless they had developed some sort of spring return mechanism on their own. Jinzan carefully avoided turning to look at Kakurt, but he was starting to wonder if perhaps he should have taken a slower approach and taught his own people how to make the cannons. It might have been a decade before they got it right, but he was starting to question the wisdom of giving these clever creatures a head start on technology.
"Excellent work," he said quietly.
Then Jinzan walked over to the other carts. There were 12 cannon in all, and several more carts bearing cannon shot and black powder. He kept a careful distance from the latter, as even in the dream world, the storage and handling of black powder was a twitchy thing. These goblins were new to the stuff and were much more tolerant of risk-taking than most humans were. If they had not had a safer design for the cannon figured out in time, they would have certainly just made do with the initial design. Abandoning the project out of concern for the newly appointed goblin cannoneers would not have occurred to them. By the following morning, the cannons were in place on the hilltop. The trees that were in the line of fire were half cut, ready to be brought down by the sorcerers when the signal was made to begin the battle. When Githak gave that signal, the sorcerers gave a great blast of wind, toppling the trees away from the direction of the camp. In a riot of reds and oranges and yellows, the fall colors of the canopy rushed to the ground in front of them. The powerful ether-driven winds stripped the leaves from the fallen trees as well and sent them swirling off in the direction of Illard's Glen. With the view of the city now exposed, Jinzan and the commanders of the army could see the massive goblin force closing on the city. Armed only with spears, the goblin infantry rushed forward toward the walls of the town. It would be several minutes before they covered the prairie between the hilltop and the wall, and they carried no easy means of surmounting the wall. That task would be left to the cannon, and if that failed, the sorcerers, particularly Jinzan, would have to clear up the mess. The Kadrin forces that defended Illard's Glen had been oblivious to the goblin presence in the forested hills around their town, but the goblin sorcerers had given up wasting ether on illusions, and the crack of dozens of falling trees could be heard even from town. Within seconds of the toppling of their tree cover, Jinzan and the goblins heard the watch bells ringing frantically from Illard's Glen, and they saw the north-facing gate being closed. Jinzan moved in directly behind the cannon. All 12 were trained on the city walls, their crews awaiting the order to fire. They were dressed as the common soldiers were, with one exception. Each was fitted with a leather helmet, thickly padded inside where it covered their ears, and a pair of goggles. It had not taken the goblin artisans long to realize the noise and smoke their new creations caused, and to devise methods of protecting their crews. As their hearing was muffled, the signal Githak gave was simply to point to the cannoneers, then to the wall. The crews turned from their leader to the chains of the cannon, and in remarkable unison, pulled the chains.
Kathoom! Kathoom!
Kathoom! Kathoom!
The concussion was thunderous. All the goblins not wearing protective helmets grabbed for their ears, even those well away from the cannon. The ground hammered on their feet from the shockwave, sending a few stumbling. The cannoneers scrambled as the recoil from their siege engines sent them backward into their midst. Jinzan just smiled. His ears rang from the blast, but he had stood his ground and barely flinched. The cannon's report was like music to him. He felt like a young boy, always barred from the tavern on nights when bards were playing, listening to muted notes that the wall allowed through. Now, finally, he was allowed to hear the music in all its glory. Seconds later, the cannonballs hit. Two plumes of rocky dust exploded from the wall. The rest either overshot or undershot their mark. The disoriented crews had seen the two plumes as well, and realized that 10 of the cannon had missed their marks. They gestured frantically amongst themselves as they struggled to push the cannon back into position and reload. There was clearly a disagreement over which had been aimed properly. Jinzan was paying closer attention, though. He strode over to the cannoneers and pointed emphatically to one, then to another, then motioned for the nearest goblin to remove his helmet. The goblin complied hastily.
That two hit. This one? Up 3 tick. Jinzan pointed to a third cannon. That one? Up 2 tick.
Jinzan ran through the rest of the cannon as best as he could estimate how much they were off, and giving instruction as to how to adjust the ratcheted mechanism the goblins had added to the cannons to adjust and hold their aim. The aiming device was an excellent idea, but he was unfamiliar with just how much each tick actually represented. Since Jinzan had only seen where a few of the shot had impacted, aside from the two that hit the wall, he was largely guessing at the adjustments anyway.
You see this time. I no see all time for you.
Jinzan's voice was already growing hoarse from speaking goblin. The one he had instructed quickly relayed his commands to the rest, and they began trying to heft the cannon back into position. They had wheels, but in the soft dirt, the blast had driven them into the ground a little, meaning they were pushing uphill, if only slightly.
Haru, Bidesi, Lioki, Quatuan, Gelora.
Jinzan set the cannon back roughly where they had started, as the startled goblins, who could not hear his spell, scrambled to get back to work loading. The loading process was amusing to watch. What would have taken a couple humans just muscle power, the goblins had developed a whole process for. There were stepladders, small carts, and a 2-goblin cradle for carrying the shot. Jinzan was not any sort of physical specimen, but he could still lift one of the cannonballs in one hand, with some difficulty. The second volley was less chaotic than the first. The commanders and sorcerers who remained on the hill knew to plug their ears as the command was given to fire. The crews kept out of the way from the recoil. Goblin sorcerers were ready to lift the cannon back into position as soon as they fired. And 9 of the 12 hit the wall, and the ones who had not made adjustments of their own. A third volley was much the same, and the town wall was breached in several spots. A cheer went up from the goblins on the hilltop as the first of the infantry reached the wall and found passage through. Arrows and grape shot rang down among the swarming masses of the goblin invaders, but so great were their numbers that they hardly slowed. The cannoneers began to stow their equipment and prepared to move down to the town. It would be in goblin hands long before they arrived. Small footfalls echoed in the vast cavern. Gaklar could have moved more quietly, but it would have been irreverent to attempt stealth, given the circumstances. The only other sounds were the faint crackling of the torches along the walls and a steady sound like a bellows. Gaklar approached the center of the cavern, where there was a promontory overlooking the shadowy depths of the lower portion of the great chamber. The torches had been placed such that their light did not reach down below. As he reached the edge, he glanced down. Seeing nothing, he let his vision delve into the ethereal realm. He saw a wash of ether flowing from a single, vast source.
Great Nehashtak, I bring important news.
Gaktlar carefully pronounced the difficult name so as not to cause offense. He swallowed hard, nervous as he had been only once before in the last several winters, which happened to be the reason for his audience. He waited for a response. There was a great stirring below. A great creaking of leather and sinew gave way to scratching of massive claws on stone, and the source closed the distance to Gaktlar. As it grew very near, he brought his vision back to reality and saw the face of his goddess. The enormous reptilian head of the dragon was covered in steel-hard greenish-brown scales, framing a pair of glowing yellowed eyes with slits like a cat's, and a parted jaw filled with teeth longer than Gaktlar was tall. A tongue darted out quickly, tasting the air near the assassin.
Your name is known to me. You are master of eternal night. You have the esteem of my attendants. I do not think you are one who would dare waste my time on a petty matter. Speak,
Nehashtak ordered, her deep voice rumbling throughout the cavern. Gaktlar could smell the carrion on her breath. The assassin was no expert on meats, but he knew it was probably caribou meat he was smelling, from the herds raised just to satiate the dragon's appetite for her favorite meal.
The plan to secure your whelp's lair is in jeopardy. The humans have allied themselves with a demon.
Gaktlar did not want to waste the dragon's time by dancing around the real reason for his urgency. The dragon's eyes narrowed.
Explain.
Your Holiness, the scouting parties ran into an unusually strong resistance from a small force of humans. One strike force was lost almost entirely, and the humans were nearly wiped out as well. The few survivors fled, and I was sent to make sure they were not able to reach help and raise an alarm against us. I found them easily, but was ambushed by the demon, who claimed the humans were under his protection. The demon toyed with me and let me flee. I came here to warn you.
Gaktlar hoped that would be sufficient, but suspected not.
So you have failed?
The dragon asked. That was the topic he had sincerely hoped the dragon would overlook.
Yes, Your Holiness,
Gaktlar bowed his head in contrition.
If I had persisted despite the demon's warning, I still would have failed, and none would have known of the demon's presence with the humans. I wished to relay a warning.
How are you sure that it is a demon? What did it look like?
Nehashtak asked. Gaktlar was not sure if the dragon believed him, and offered a silent prayer to Nehashtak that he be spared. It was a brief moment, but Gaktlar almost laughed when he realized his logical error.
It looks human, though small for one of their kind, with white hair. It looks young, but not childlike. I knew it was a demon because of my ether sight. The demon sheds no ether,
the assassin explained.
Perhaps it is a fault in your ether vision, then.
Your pardon, Holiness, but I do not believe so. In my ether vision, you are a vast, shining beacon of life, and all lesser creatures are smaller lights. I use my ether sight to help track my prey, and I assure you, this demon was the farthest opposite of you. In the ether sight, he is a ghost. I can see his body with my eyes, but there is no source to be seen. He is not alive, but he is powerful. Is that not the definition of a demon?
In my lifetime, I have not seen a demon, but all you say of this one strikes true to the tales of them. There are sorcerers among the army gone to claim my Rukputkan in his lair, but none that I would trust to stand against a demon. I will go, and I will see that this demon does not spoil the conquest of the human settlement that Rook Putkan will take for his new home,
Nehashtag said.
Attendance!
The mighty dragon bellowed, shaking the walls and causing the torches to flicker. A maelstrom of activity ensued, with scores of goblins in brown robes flocking to their goddess's call. They swarmed the promontory and filled the area behind Gaklar, barring his path out, though that consideration was far from their thoughts.
Prepare me for battle. I will go to war,
Nehashtag growled.
And Lorekeeper, let it show that Gaklar has performed admirably. There will be no mark of failure upon his record.
The dragon priests in attendance sprang into action, for there was much to be done before the vainglorious dragon goddess would deem herself fit to fight. There were oils to be rubbed into her leathery wings, teeth and claws to be filed and sharpened. Scales would be checked for cracks and chips and cleaned of debris. The headdress of gold and silks that Nehashtag wore when venturing out from her lair would be cleaned and refitted to the dragon's ever-growing head. She had not worn it in ages. Then there was an entourage to assemble. No infantry to slow Nehashtag's passage, but swift-mounted riders from among her loyal attendants. Nehashtag would not fly to battle, but walk among her retainers, a swift pace to be sure, but it would not do for her to outdistance her servants by taking to the air. There was much to be done, but little work for Nehashtag herself. She settled down to enjoy the pampering of her priests. She had planning to do, though, and hoped that it would all sort itself out before she arrived. If they had a demon among them, she would prefer it show its powers against her worshippers first, before she had to deal with it.